Good morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. Time is 9:03, March 11, 2026. With me today is Chairman Hoffman and Olson, Senator Keel, Senator Merrick, Senator Coppins, Senator Cronk, myself, Stedman. We are going to change the schedule a little bit today. We are going to have a presentation this morning dealing with House Bill 78. It's one item on the agenda. It's retirement systems, defined benefit option. We're going to hear a presentation from the Department of Administration. This is the first time they've been asked to come and testify actually on the bill and not just answer questions, so it'll be interesting to see what they have to say. Then we're going to adjourn the morning session, and then we'll reconvene at 1:30 and have Legislative Finance Division come forward and talk about the same subject matter, dealing with the finances and employee turnover or whatever they want to talk about. But initially, we were going to have them both back-to-back this morning, but we have some work to do before we have the floor today. So we're going to just do the one presentation, then adjourn and pick up in the afternoon. So apologize for having people change the schedule, but that's the way it works. So with me today, House Bill 78, Retirement Systems Defined Benefit Option. This is the fourth hearing on this bill. We've got an invitation out to this is Kathy Lee, Division of Retirement and Benefits, if she can come forward. She also has with her Christopher Novell, Division of Retirement and Benefits also, and online is David Keschner from Gallagher's, is a actuary. And if you could, Kathy Lee, if you could introduce yourself for the record, who you represent. I think you're going to lead the way today on this presentation. Is that correct? Or
I will lead the way.
Okay, thank you. And go ahead and take it away. And I'll watch the clock. So the latest we'll run on this section will be 10 o'clock. We should be done before then, though.
Okay, for the record, my name is Kathy Lee. I'm the director of the Division of Retirement and Benefits. And we thank the committee for the opportunity to speak on House Bill 78. We've designed our presentation because this is a very complex issue. We've designed our presentation, hopefully, in plain English so people have an easier time of understanding it. We're going to go over defined benefit plan history very shortly, an updated comparison of the DB and DC contribution retirement benefits, the conversion process, the actuarial review, the impact on the state of Alaska contributions that are for employers. Once the employers reach the cap, the state pays an additional amount. HB 78 is going to affect that, and it will also affect the contributions the state makes as an employer. So first, a little history. Just like building a house, you need to pay attention to the design before you build it to make sure you're getting what you want. So this is a little bit about defined benefit design. So the first defined benefit plan was established in 1875 by the American Express Company. To receive benefits, you had to be age 60 or older with 20 years of service, but the life expectancy in 1875 was 40 to 44 years. So many employees did not reach retirement eligibility or received benefits for very few years. And that is the core design of a DB plan. More money coming in than you're paying out. PERS was established in 1962, and TERS was established in 1955. And they perked along quite fine until about 1986. And as the unfunded liability in each plan increased, new tiers were created. So for PERS, Tier 2 was created in 1986 because liability was growing, and so cost containment measures were put in to hold the line on costs. We had actuarial valuations then that made it look like this was the solution. And I'd like to just give a little tidbit about actuarial valuations. Our actuaries are very talented people, but the one thing they don't have is a crystal ball. So when they give an actuarial valuation, this is a very highly educated guess as to what will happen in the future. But that calculation is based on everything remaining the same. Inflation remaining the same, investment return remaining the same, payouts to members remaining the same. So when you look at an actuarial valuation, you need to keep that in mind. So the actual experience of the plan did not match the valuation. So in 1996, Tier 3 was created, again, adding more cost containment measures to keep the liability in check. You had to wait longer to retire. Alaska cost of living allowances were changed. The Alaska COLA for living in Alaska was also reduced by making it, you had to be 65 in order to have it instead of right at retirement. And then in 2006, we changed to the defined contribution plan because liabilities were getting out of control again. Same thing happened in the teacher's retirement system with Tier 2 in 1990 and the DCR plans in 2006. When all of these tiers were considered, actuarial valuations were given, and it was the best information you could have at that time to make that decision. But things changed. They didn't follow what the actuary had assumed. So HB 78 retirement is generally with 30 years of service. The life expectancy in 2026 now is 81 for women and 76 for men. And that's important to know because if you have a joint survivor option, we're paying at the age for women, whether they're the member or they're the survivor. And so that age 81 is very important. So current DB tiers are paying, the current ones, are paying benefits in some cases for longer than the member worked to earn them. And you contrast that with the basic design where very few people were drawing benefits from the plan.
Okay, we're going to wait until she's done with the slides and we'll go our standard process here.
Okay. I am done with this slide.
Okay. Senator Keel.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. good morning. Thanks for being here. Always good to get the theoretical perspective. I wouldn't want anybody to get the impression that American Express was ripping off the workers. If you lived to be 20 in 1875, you could expect to live to be 65. So that life expectancy was included a whole lot of child mortality, and those people never started working for American Express. So this is great perspective, and it's good to keep a big picture in mind. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Any other questions on this slide? Okay, next slide, please.
Okay, so we are going to turn the time over to our actuary, David Kirshner, to explain the updated DB and DCR benefit comparisons that we're using. The rates of return that we're using, we received from the Department of Revenue, Division of Treasury, and the actual returns from the DCR plan.
Okay, Mr. Kirshner, if you can introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and take us through, I guess we're on slide 5.
Okay, good morning. Can everyone hear me okay?
Yes.
All right, great. Good morning. My name is David Kirshner. I'm an actuary with Gallagher, and we work with the Division of Retirement Benefits to provide the annual actuarial valuations, which are then used by the ARM Board to set the contribution rates for funding PERS and TERS. Before we get into the HB 78 specifics, we have provided on slides 5, 6, and 7 illustrations of comparing for sample employees the defined benefit amounts and the defined contribution amounts. I'm going to, if we move to slide 5, there are a lot of numbers here, obviously. I'm going to focus on the top left box. Each of these boxes is a different sample employee, and this slide 5 is specific to PERS, peace officers, and firefighters, comparing the defined benefit amounts for Tier 3 versus the defined contribution amounts for Tier 4. And in the top left, each of the boxes are the same. They just vary by the what retirement age we're assuming. So if we look at the top left box, sample employee 1 is assumed to retire at age 50, and all of these sample employees are assumed to be hired at age 25. So this individual sample employee would have 25 years of service, and under the defined benefit tier is eligible for an unreduced benefit after 20 years. So if we look at the defined benefit column, the years of service is at 25. The projected salary, which we're assuming starts at $60,000 at higher and then increases at 2.75% per year, would be the $118,000 at retirement. Under the defined benefit plan, the annual benefit that this sample employee would be eligible to receive as a lifetime annuity is $64,400. And then if you go down to the next row, you can see incorporating the cost of living adjustments, which is the post-retirement pension adjustments, acronym is PRPA, that many people use, benefit has now increased under our assumed inflationary environment to just under $70,000, and then 10 years later has increased to about $81,500 per year. Then the next line down, the present value of the benefit at retirement under the DB column is the $1.5 million. That's the present value of all future benefits at the retirement age, in this case age 50, including all of the projected post-retirement pension adjustments. So that's the value. In other words, if we were to deposit that amount at this person's retirement age and all of our assumptions in the future were met, that $1.5 million would be invested and then in the trust and then would accumulate with earnings and would be available to pay all future benefits for as long as this person is expected to live. Then the last row is the total member contributions that are payable. In this case, peace officers and firefighters contribute 7.5% of pay every year. So that's the first column. Then the next two columns are the same information, but under the defined contribution tier, assuming that the individual receives either a 10% annual return on their defined contribution accounts or a 12% return on their defined contribution accounts. Last year, we had done similar illustrations, and we had used returns of 5% and 7%. We were asked to update them this year to 10 and 12, which is more indicative, as Kathy mentioned, of the actual returns received within the DCR accounts. So not as everyone probably knows, in a defined contribution environment, the amount of the benefit is dependent on what the member receives in their investment. So you can see if they receive a 10% return, we're projecting at retirement an annual benefit of $51,000, versus if they receive a 12% return, an annual benefit of about $68,500. Those are the same in each of the next two rows because there is no cost of living adjustment built into the defined contribution plan. Now, a member could elect to receive an indexed annuity that incorporates some sort of cost of living, but their pot of money that they have to buy that annuity is the same. So the starting amount would be lower to take into account any future increases. And then you can see the present value of benefit of retirement grow for the 10% return. That's the accumulated DC account balance of $1 million with a 10% return versus $1.3 million in the 12%. And then finally, the next row is the total employee contributions, and all defined contribution members contribute 8% of pay. And then finally, the fourth column is what annual return would the defined contribution member need in this sample employee scenario to accumulate an amount of money that is equivalent to the present value of the defined benefit amount, which is that $1.5 million. So you can see in this case, they would need an annual return of about 12.8%. to generate that $1.5 million. So the key takeaways from this slide and the next slide, which is for other PERS employees, and then the slide 7 is for TERS sample employees. The key takeaways are that the defined contribution members' benefits can exceed what the defined benefit members receive, depending on what investment return the defined contribution member receives and how long, when they retire. So if they delay their retirement, you can see, for example, if we go down to the next, the bottom left box, that's retiring 10 years later. You can see in the present value of benefit at retirement row, the accumulated DC accounts are much larger because they've been working and contributing and accumulating for another 10 years. So the comparison, the DB benefit, of course, is a guaranteed annual benefit that includes the post-retirement pension adjustments as CPI index increases, whereas the DC accounts DC benefits depend on what returns they get and how long they are investing that money. And so I won't go through all of the sample employees. You can see the numbers, how they change, but it's basic, the same information and same conclusions.
Okay, and I think...
Are there any questions?
Yes, this is a highlight. This is Tier 3, which is not the House Bill 78. I just want to make that
clear. That's correct.
And then after we go, we have a question from Senator Keel, and then we'll go to 6, the next slide, when the questions are done, because that'll deal with PERS. Go ahead, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Kirshner, thanks for being with us. You said that these sample returns were updated to be closer to the DC plan experience. Over what time period? Are these 10 and 12% what folks are getting since inception or just last year? Or what are we talking about?
Yes, through the chair. Senator, we've received various returns, one-year returns, three-year, five-year, all the way up to 16 years. And, for example, the target date funds, the annualized return over the 16-year period was 10.49%, and the 7-year average return target date funds was 12.7%, and the most recent 1 year was just under 19%. So we received various returns, and the 10 and 12 are very indicative of longer terms. It's not just a 1 or 2 year snapshot that we looked at. We took returns over basically a 15-year period.
And a follow-up, if I may. Thank you. And are those the returns in the individual member accounts? Are people 100% in the target date funds?
These are the returns that I just quoted are taken from the target date funds. And they came directly, as Ms. Lee mentioned, from the Department of Revenue. So I believe these are the actual average target date funds across all members within the DCR plan.
So, sorry, Mr. Chairman, I asked that question unclearly. Mr. Kirshner, can you tell us how these returns, the returns of the funds that are actually used by the people in the target in the DC plans, how they correspond to the actual investment choices made by the people in the DC plan. Are folks half in a target date fund and half in a money market? Are folks pulling in and out of the market when it goes up and down and switching to the balanced fund at the bottom of a market lag? What are the actual investment experiences of the plan members, and how do they correlate to these numbers?
Yes, through the chair. Yes, thank you for clarifying your question. The total plan returns for all across all investments are slightly below the target date funds, but they're still in that same vicinity. So, for example, the 15-year target date average return was 10.25. The total plan was 9.32. So the target date funds are slightly higher returns, but they're the total plan returns, including all investments, not just target date funds, are still in, on average, in that 10 to 12% range over the longer term.
Thank you. One more?
Yeah, go ahead, Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Kirshner. That's helpful. And then can you help me understand, as you look at the present value of the benefits, what's your assumption about returns after the point of retirement? Do we assume that they continue to earn at that same annualized rate for the DC, or how do you calculate that?
At the present value figures?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. What's the Mr. Kirshner, what's the assumption that you make about returns after the point of retirement?
Well, up until retirement, it's either the 10 or the 12%. And then at retirement, the present value, the figures in the present value row in the DC column, that's just the accumulated account balance as either with a 10 or 12% return. The present value, and then we annuitize that benefit using a 30-year average of 10-year constant maturity treasury yields, which was 3.74%. And then when we calculated the present value of the defined benefit amount at retirement, we also used that 3.74 to keep as much of an apples-to-apples comparison. So the DC returns are either 10 or 12% through retirement, and then at retirement, we converted everything using the 30-year average constant maturities, which was 3.74%.
Thank you.
And just for the committee's information, we'll have a presentation here in a couple of weeks from Department of Revenue that'll go into more detail on the returns of the asset selections, portfolio selections, and I think you'll see that most of the weighting of the current employees are going into the age-weighted funds. But they're going to show us the weightings of all of the fund selections and how many dollars and how many employees are in those in more detail. Coming attractions. And those returns are going to look pretty handsome, which is nice to have at the table, because all of the state employees are in SBS, Supplemental Benefit System, and replacement of Social Security. A lot of the newer ones are in the defined contribution plan, and then we have deferred compensation plan and the TERS, a new plan. They're all in the same within just a handful of basis points of each other. So that'll be a coming presentation. Okay, seeing no questions on this slide, we'll go to slide number six.
Okay, slide number six is the same information. This is now for a PERS other, all other PERS employees, non-peace officers and firefighters. Again, tier three within the defined benefit, which is not the tier for the HB 78 versus tier four under, which is DC, defined contribution. For PERS others, they can retire at any time after 30 years. So we've shown here the we have three sample employees retiring after either 30 years, 35 years, 40. And it's the same information that I just went through similar conclusions that we just discussed. And then the following slide, slide 7, is for TERS sample employees who can retire with an unreduced benefit within the Tier 2 defined benefit after 25 years.
Okay,
so again, same information, same conclusions.
Right. So do we have any questions on 6? Seeing none, slide 7 is TERS. And maybe could you go over one of the boxes in on slide 7? That's been a concern as far as the status of the teacher's retirement system relative to the previous tier, which was Tier 2. Could you help just walk us through that so it's clear to the public what we're dealing with here?
Sure. So again, I'll focus on the top left box, which is sample employee number 1, who's assumed to retire at age 50 with 25 years of service, which is Tier 2 within TERS. Tier 2 within the defined benefit can retire with an unreduced benefit within the defined benefit plan after 25 years of service. So we've shown here the first retirement age at 50, in this case, would have 25 years. And it's the same information, the projected salary and retirement, it's the same for all rows, so all columns, because it's the same assumed salary increases. In this case, the TERS defined benefit of sample employee 1 at age 50 would be eligible for an annual benefit of a little over $58,800 per year, payable for the member's lifetime. And then after 10 years of retirement, with 10 years of post-retirement pension adjustments, that annual benefit would be $61,000 per year. And then after another 10 years of post-retirement pension adjustments, that annual benefit would be about $71,700 per year. And then the present value at retirement is that $1,340,000. And then in this case, the TERS employee contribution is 8.65% of pay. So the TERS DB participant would be projected to contribute a little over $183,000 over that 25-year period. And then the next two columns are the same information, except assuming a 10% or 12% DC returns. And if we jump down to the present value of benefit at retirement row, in the 10% return, you can see that this employee is expected to accumulate DC account balance of $1.154 million. With a 12% return, that would be a little over $1.5 million, which is actually more than the present value of benefit at retirement for the defined benefit participant. And then the final column is the annual return that this sample employee would need to have the same equivalent present accumulated value equal to the present value of the defined benefit participant, which in this case is 11%.
Okay, thank you. And then we have age 55, age 60, and age 65 on retirement on that. I think the conversation was on age 50, which is pretty young to retire. At least at my age, when I'm 70, it looks pretty young. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We won't comment on your youth or sprightliness. Not at the table, anyway. Mr. Kirshner, my understanding is that this is relatively close to the standard age of a starting teacher in TERS. Can you tell us how these numbers shift if we talk about a teacher who comes in at a later age? What actually, maybe you could remind us, what is the average entry age for a TERS teacher?
Through the chair, Senator, I don't have that information offhand. I'm not sure if Ms. Lee would have that information.
We can get back to the committee on that.
Okay.
Yeah. You have a question?
But.
Go ahead.
Okay. But the effect that we've assumed here that all of these sample employees would be hired at age 25. The effect of being hired later within the defined benefit plan is that their first age of being eligible for an unreduced benefit would be delayed. So, for example, if a teacher were to be hired at, say, age 35 instead of 25, the first year that they would be eligible for an unreduced benefit would be age 60, because they would need 25 years of service for an unreduced benefit within the defined benefit plan. So we'd be looking at something more in the line of when I say 35 to 60 would be 25 years. That would be the effect on the defined benefit side. On the defined contribution side, it would have perhaps even a more effect, because the defined contribution accounts, as we know from our individual savings into IRAs or 401ks or 403bs, the earlier you start contributing, the earlier you start accumulating and compounding returns. So if you don't start saving in the defined contribution plan until, for example, age 35 instead of 25, your future accumulated balances would be significantly reduced, because you've lost those early 10 years of compounding contributions along with compound interest. So it can have a significant impact and would cause the accumulated defined contribution account balances to be significantly lower than what we have illustrated here.
Okay, thank you. Okay, next slide, please. Slide number 8.
Before we start this slide, I just wanted to make one point clear. On the previous slides, we were talking about cost of living increases and whatnot. I need to point out that with HB 78, the retirement benefit is guaranteed, but the buying power is not, because at any time, the what we call the post-retirement pension adjustment that adjusts for inflation, if the funds are below 90%, the members won't get that. And there's no provision to make up for any buying power losses at the point when the funds are in the financial condition where they can get them. So that's the difference between this tier and tier 3. And I notice there's a tendency for everyone to think this is just like tier 3, and it's not.
All right. Okay.
Okay, for the record, my name is Christopher Novell. I'm from the Department of Division of Retirement and Benefits. I'm the Chief Financial Officer. So I'm going to go over the next few slides, and I'm going to start with just a brief overview of enrollment into HB 78 tiers and DCR, or defined contribution as it stands at the moment. So this first slide shows that the current DCR employees would have 180 days to opt into the HB 78 tier, the defined benefit tier. The DCR's the defined contribution members' balance will be actuarially converted to service credits, and this may create an indebtedness for the member to address. And also, new employees going forward will be automatically enrolled into HB 78. So this slide talks to the more in more detail as to the conversion process. Firstly, the first step will be to calculate each member's defined benefit, pensions, actuarial accrued liability, and that'll be based on primarily on their service, but also their balance. If the DC account balance exceeds the AAL, the actuarial accrued liability, the member will be credited with all of their DCR service into the DB plan. If the AAL exceeds the DC account balance, or a shortfall in other words, the member will be credited with a portion of their DCR service into the DB plan. But there also will be an opportunity to address the indebtedness to meet the service shortfall. The amounts will be transferred from DCR to the HB78DB tier, and any excess DC balance will be returned to the member's DC account. So this slide is a quick overview of the defined contribution plan as it stands at the moment. We have 149 PERS and TERS employers, and we have, as of June 30, 2025, 35,144 DCR active members. The little donut chart at the bottom is demonstrating that the current DCR year's service, showing that 56% of DCR members are between 5 to 10 years. Am I got that right? Sorry, over 5 years. Thank you.
And maybe you can get back to the committee on the percentages of these colored bars. Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. That's what I was wondering. In the 10-plus, kind of a sensitive area, so the weighting of how many people are within that 10-plus years, much closer to retirement. So kind of the gradient of people that are just about to reach a retirement age would be good to know. Thank you.
Through the chair, yes, I can do that. This data was actually taken from the State of Alaska Workforce Profile, which I think was presented earlier, and I kind of broke it down smaller so I can break it out as well.
That'll be fine. Yeah. Any other questions on this slide? Okay, slide number 11.
Okay, now we're going to move into the unfunded liability risk management. So HB 78 provides two risk sharing provisions if the funding status of HB 78 subtrusts fall below 90%. The first one is that the ARM board can reduce, the Alaska Retirement Management Board can reduce the post-retirement pension adjustments, the PRPAs, for HB 78 members. And the ARM board can also increase the HB 78 members' employee contribution rate from 8% to as much as 12%. So Gallagher, our actuary, does not project based on the valuation assumptions that it will fall below 90%. However, depending on a future experience, it is possible that the funded status of HB 78 subtrusts could fall below 90%, and in that case, those two risk-sharing provisions would be triggered. So I'm going to talk about that risk now. So looking at unfunded liability risks, the major risks facing HB 78 subtrusts are similar to any risks for a defined benefit plan, and those six are listed there. There's the investment risk, that is the asset returns will be below the expected return. Kind of similar, the long-term return on investment risk. This means that changes in long-term capital assumptions of the plan's asset allocation will result in a change in the investment return assumption. And contribution risk, that the contributions will be less than the actuarially determined contributions, creating a shortfall. And, of course, longevity risk, participants live longer. Salary risk, salaries are increasing greater than expected. And lastly, inflation risk, that inflation is greater than expected. But I'm going to focus on just the investment risk in the next slide.
Wait, before you go there, Senator Keel.
Thank you. I guess just a question for Mr. Novell. Any of these ever go the other way? We ever have these assumptions wrong in a way that ends up to the good?
Through the chair to Senator Keel, I'd imagine that would be the case, but I could defer. Do you want me to refer to David Kirshner for precise examples of when that happened? But yeah, returns can return favorably, and people can have shorter lives.
I think, Mr. Chairman, that those are great examples. I think the example I was thinking of was salary expectations have shifted, and the growth hasn't been what we built into the plan. So, yeah, just worth noting. It's probably always good to look at the low side, but there are also high side risks.
I think, Senator Keel, if the actuary was crystal ball was accurate, we'd never have an unfunded liability. And clearly, we don't have surplus problems. We have liability issues. So I think they have trouble. And even salary risk, salary growth, and mortality table growth have been, and health care over the years have been very difficult to handle. Although we've got, I think, health care under control and surplus, which is good. But yes, they can go in both directions. There's no doubt about that. Can you go ahead and continue on 13?
Thank you. So here we're going to look in more detail at the unfunded liability risk, and we're going to use a specific example. And the event shown here is that market returns are 0% for three consecutive fiscal years, and we're choosing FY27 through FY29. In this case, the projected funded status of the HB78 subtrust as of June 2030, would be 88% for PERS and 89% for TERS. And because these funded ratios are below 90%, the ARM board would need to decide whether to use those risk provisions to either reduce the PRPA benefits or increase the members' contributions. Gallagher went into some more detail with this example, and they so to avoid an increase in the FY31 state contributions, one of the following actions would have need to happen. They'd have to increase the HP78 members' contribution rates to more than 9%, or they'd have to increase the members' contribution rate to 9% and reduce the PRPAs. So the obvious choices here would negatively impact or could negatively impact retirees and or active employees. Active employees could see their take-home reduced as contributions are increased, or retirees could see their benefits reduced in real terms with the adjustment to PRPA. Also, as Cathy laid out, in the event that the PRPA is reduced by the ARM board, there is not a function to restore the buying power of the member when the conditions causing the adjustments have improved.
Okay. Question, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A 0% return for three consecutive fiscal years, have we ever had that in the pension trusts?
Through the chair, I don't recall an event where that happened. Turning to Director Lee.
He would know more better than us.
Can I defer?
I couldn't hear you.
We're going to punt to David Kirshner.
Okay. Mr. Kirshner, can you help us with the returns? And we can also, in future presentations, ask that to Department of Revenue. Can you help us with the return hypothesis that we could have a net zero return over 3 years?
Yes, David Kirshner from Gallagher. We have not seen such a return in such a scenario. I believe we could all conclude is pretty unlikely. We first looked at potentially a 0% return for two consecutive years, fiscal 27, fiscal 28. In that example, the subtrusts were still above 90%. So then we extended it to see what would it take to get the subtrust to fall below 80%, and it would basically be 3 years of 0% returns, which means since we're assuming a 7.25% return, we're losing almost 22% of return over those 3 years. So I would say that this scenario is highly unlikely, which is why when we did our fiscal note analysis for HB78, we did not project the subtrust to fall below 90%. And it would take some pretty draconian results, such as 3 years of 0% return to cause those to be less than 90%. Now, there are other scenarios where we could see a combination of less than expected salary asset returns combined with years where this, say, salary increases are higher than expected. So there's a lot of different combinations that we could, scenario combinations that we could create to cause this, but we just wanted to give the committee a sense of how, what it would take, for example, for it to fall below 90%, and it would take 3 years of 0%, which, as I said, has not happened in the past, and I would say is probably a low probability of happening in reality.
I think that most of the time when we get into this type of discussion, we look at even beyond 3 years, we look at, you know, decades. It seemed like the financial markets swing, and we had conversations here a little bit ago with the permanent fund talking about what happens if we have a decade of below market returns, below average returns. So I think it's a pretty short time frame here. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And stress tests are a good idea, right? We shouldn't build a system on Pollyanna assumptions. This one is Cassandra. So it's good to know. Thank you. A question then about these lines in here about adjusting the retirees' adjustments, PRPAs, post-retire. So maybe it's a two-part question. The first is, under the bill in front of us, under HB 78, are we looking at full inflation adjustments as a baseline, or is it partial inflation adjustments? And then the second part would be, if they get reduced, how did that compare to a defined contribution employee's post-retirement adjustment?
Through the chair to Senator Keel, if I can just get the details of the PRPA as they stand. As they stand at the moment, the adjustment is done based on the CPI, which, as of July 2025, in that example, for 60 to 65, 60, 64-year-olds, it's 1.053% of the CPI during 2024. So it's based on the CPI calculation.
Mr. Chairman, full CPI? Is the PRPA full CPI?
Yes. So if you, the PRPA based on July the 1st, 2025, for 60 to 64-year-olds, you receive 50% of the 50% of the or 1.0353% increase. Yeah.
Could you repeat that so we can understand what you're talking about?
I'll try. through the chair. So I've taken the example of the requirements for PRPA as of July the 1st, 2025, and in that case, they will receive 50% of the CPI. So that would mean a 1.053% rise in their benefits.
They get half of the inflation adjustment.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay, half of inflation. Thanks. I want to keep things simple. Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. The modeling of, you know, the zero return for 3 years, I had earlier asked the question about the cohort in the longer service period, what those numbers might be. And what I'm looking at there is who might buy into the system using credits in their DC plan, buy into the system. They're buying in at a high valuation where we are. I mean, the secular bull market we've been in is just incredible. I don't think anyone could have expected that this would have gone like it does, but all springs coil and they go in both directions. So if the stress testing I would like to see would be the potential that we implement this, people buy into it with highly valued assets that have ridden this bull market, and then we have a sudden turn, and then there's a cohort that immediately become eligible for retirement at the buy-in that they were able to do at that point. So should we implement this and there be a correction afterwards, and that correction pulls down hard, and then there's a cohort that are eligible to retire at that point. What's the financial impact to this system? If that may sound like kind of a black swan event, but it's really not. It's such a thing could happen after an extended bull run like we've had, and if people are getting credited at that rate and building those credits based on highly escalated values of assets, it would be interesting to see what kind of stress test premise that would put forth. Thank you.
Through the chair, Senator Kaufman, are you asking us to calculate the cost of a current DC person converting to the DB pension plan?
It would be the cost of, you know, so not the cost of buying into it, but so if they buy into it with the current value of their DC plan and they're close to retirement, so they bought into it at that high rate. And then basically, if you're ready for retirement, you could cash in your chips immediately after because you've got a guaranteed, mm-hmm. you know, you bought right at the top of the market. And then you kind of got a golden ticket, so to speak. And so I'm just wondering if there's been modeling done that takes the high value, high relative valuation of the assets, looks at some reversion to the mean, and compares that with the cohort that could immediately take advantage of basically having sustained the valuation of their assets through the buy-in process?
Through the chair, Senator Kaufman, we have run a report to determine how many people, if they converted, would be either immediately eligible or eligible within the next 2 years. We currently have about 30 between both systems that would be able to do that.
In what time frame is that? Immediately?
Either immediately or within the next 2 years.
2 years, okay. Okay. I'd like to see that.
Okay. Go on and continue then. And if we run out of time, we'll invite you back this afternoon, if that's okay.
Yes. Okay. Sorry.
Page 14.
Okay.
Moving right along.
So the next few pages next few slides, I'm moving away for the unfunded liability, and we're going to look at the costs to the state. And the overlying question is, why are the state contributions projected to increase as they are? The long story short is that the benefits under HB 78 have greater value, and so therefore, logically, the costs are going to go up accordingly. And the slide in front of you gives you a pretty much side-by-side analysis of those benefits for DCR members versus HB 78 member benefits.
Do you want to walk us through this slide?
I can do. So, As you can see, the occupational death and disabilities are the same for both members. Healthcare is almost the same, but there is a slight the cost for healthcare is projected to be slightly larger. Misused the word slightly. It's going to be larger under HB 78 as it's expected that there's going to be a higher employee retention, so that's going to increase the healthcare costs. Employer contributions to the HRA members account are 3% of pay, and it's 4% for peace and fire, and 3% for PERS employers, so there's a slight increase in HRA.
And what does that mean? HRA?
Health reimbursement accounts. That's what DCR members pay into, and they become vested after 10 years, and that moves across to the new HB 78 members' benefits. The obvious difference is that there's a lifetime pension for the HB 78 DB members. And lastly, the post-retirement pension adjustments will be with the defined benefit members, which obviously isn't present in defined contribution.
Do we have any questions on this slide? Okay, next slide.
So, still going forward with the question, why are state contributions projected to increase? The additional costs of all these are going to have to fall directly to the state. There's the higher cost of the HB 78 benefits, which I just outlined. So the actuarially determined contribution rate is expected to increase if based on that. This is for additional state contributions. The additional state contribution rate already exceeds the statutory employer rates of 22% for PERS and 12.56% for TERS. Therefore, the higher ADC rates to HB 78 will increase the additional state contributions. And regarding state as an employer contributions, because the state pays the full additional, the full actuarially determined rate for PERS, the whole amount will fall to the state as an employer.
Okay, I think we're going to stop here. I think we'll pick up at 1:30. We're going to probably do 15 again, the slide 15 again, because it matches in with the following slide, so we can have some continuity, and we can talk about the costs and some of the liability exposures and other questions that committee members may have think of between now and then. And we'll adjourn here now for a little break. We do appreciate the department and time and effort, and we don't expect you to be able to answer every question any of us can think of to throw down the table, so you're doing well. So we are adjourned at 10 a.m., and we'll pick up this afternoon at 1:30. We are adjourned.